Welcome to the October 1st edition of Baffert Spears Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor in Santa Cruz. I'm your host, Robert. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, on your FM dial. This is a pre-recorded show, pre-recorded because this evening there are many things happening downtown that I recommend you do, even over listening to this fine radio program. If you have a portable radio, take it with you. If you don't, skip this show and head on down to the Civic Auditorium right across from City Hall and catty corner from the library. There's a fiesta for the poor starting right now, a fiesta for the Beach Flats residents, a fiesta for the community, which is provided by Joe Schultz. Features tamales, rice and beans, very tasty food. It's support for the Beach Flats residents who are coming to speak to the City Council, or to try to, since City Council has closed oral communications and doesn't seem to be listening to anybody who has spoken at oral communications anyway. This is happening down at the Civic from 6 to 7, thereabouts. Then at 6:30, right in the Civic Auditorium, is when the actual oral communications continues. This is, again, supposed to be only the remainder of the list. Almost everyone on the list that's left, possibly everyone, is speaking against the Beach Area South of Laurel plan, which, for those of you newcomers who are just tuning in, is the redevelopment plan to kick out the poor Latino families in the Beach Flats area and give $10 million in benefits, property, at the very least, and funding to Charlie Canfield of the Seaside Company for its expansion along the 3rd Street realignment, the La Bahia Hotel Complex, bridge over the street between La Bahia and the boardwalk, and so forth. And this is all going to be voted on October 6th in a rush job by the Rotkin Matthews City Council, or the Canfield City Council, as I call it, in honor of Charlie Canfield, who is the chief man behind the boardwalk. And tonight, there is the last bit of oral communications before the rubber stamping on the 6th, which is the next Tuesday. That's happening tonight at the Civic Auditorium. You can chow down, you can hopefully try to speak out. We're hoping the City Council will expand the oral communication time to allow the actual people who are living in the beach area to be able to speak to the issues. And we're going to have an interview later in the program for those of you who can't go down to this activity or have something else you need to do, but who can still stay near the radio. You'll be able to hear activist Phil Baer discussing the latest ins and outs, particularly of today's Santa Cruz urinal story. The urinal, that's what I call the Santa Cruz Sentinel, our monopoly paper, compliments of the Wall Street Journal, and the locals who are running it for them. So that's why I'm not on tape live. That's why you're hearing me canned, so to speak, today. But if you have any comments or thoughts or questions or anything at all that you want to respond to, or any responses you want to make, you can give a call to me at 423-HUP, 423-4833. HUP is an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. I'm going to be speaking on behalf of HUP at the City Council tonight around the Beach Area South of Laurel plan, and hopefully I'll read you my speech on Sunday, because when I'm recording it at the moment, this is being recorded hours before the council meeting, I haven't quite finished writing it yet. So it looks interesting. Not only is there a City Council oral communications meeting today at 6:30 at the Civic, there's also a meeting of the candidates at Bayview School, the candidates running for City Council on November 3rd, and that'll be up at Mission and Bay Street. If you want to go up there, that starts at 7:30. You can hustle on back to the City Council chambers right across from the Civic, the City Hall area, and be able to listen to the Planning Commission talk about Terrace Point, another developer bonanza, compliments of our City Council, which hopefully will be turned out at the next election, but that's going to be quite a job. We need to capture 3 seats. There are 4 progressives running for 3 seats and 3 conservatives, probably better funded than the 4 progressives, so it's going to be quite a race. We also had some other good news this week. Brian Andrus, the man shot 5 times by 4 police officers. Actually, I think only 3 of them were shooting, but one of them broke in. That was Officer Durazio. Then Sergeant Hennig, Officer Berry, and Officer Zamanek peppered Brian Andrus with bullets in the back, buttock, foot, chest, and I think one other place, and shoulder. And he was He was in critical condition when the officers were fit for duty within six hours. But his wife was then held in isolation at the police station. Sergeant Clark came in and tried to grill him and get a statement while he was comatose. All kinds of weird, abusive police practices around this case. A shooting on Button Street back in March. But of course, the DA chooses to attack the victim and choose him for prosecution. He was defending himself, or at his household, with a baseball bat from these cops that had shoved in without permission from the owner, without any significant reason for doing so. They claimed there was a domestic violence case they were investigating, but the woman showed herself at the window, asked them to leave, showed her body. She wasn't obviously being injured. They certainly could have used a less confrontive, abusive approach. They shoved their way in, they grabbed her, they pushed her aside, they wrenched her arms up above her head, and they were promptly attacked by Brian Andrews with a baseball bat, who hit one of them in the chest, one of them in the finger, and himself, as I said, got shot five times and is now facing years in jail and four felonies on police officers. We're going to have a full update on that case, hopefully on Sunday, when we'll be hearing from Becky Johnson and other folks who went to the trial, if she consents to go on the air. There's also going to be, what happened with that trial was there was a mistrial, a hung jury, 10-2 for conviction. And we're hoping to get more details from the jurors, if we can reach them, which may be a difficulty because I think they seal those records. And the attorney in this case has not been terribly cooperative. The defense, of course, is scared shitless that they're going to face years and years in jail. And their main concern is just getting the hell out of there. To heck with what happens to other people in the neighborhood. To heck with the police situation there. I mean, they naturally are very concerned about simply the safety of the man who's been ramrodded through the court system, Brian Andrews, and that's understandable. But my primary concern, I think a lot of this, is that these kinds of police practices stop. That the shooting of Happy John Dine, the failure of citizen police review here, has to be held in check, has to be reversed, and we need a police department that is truly responsive to the community and not some sort of hot-dogging boys in blue who run around waking up people who sleep at night and harassing people on the mall and shooting folks who don't open the door even though there's no search warrant and no probable cause to enter. Anyway, we're going to be hearing from that group on hopefully some commentary on that on Sunday. And we'll be playing a little bit of an interview with Rick Peterson way back in March, which you heard before if you were listening at that time, to give you an idea of what one witness, who the prosecution, I should say, and the objected to and the judge refused to call, Rick Peterson. I believe the prosecution objected to him, certainly Judge Addick, who ruled the courtroom with an iron fist, refused to allow the defense to call that witness. And in spite of all that, we have two courageous jurors who said not guilty and refused to change their view. That could be called jury nullification, or perhaps it's just straight and simple reasonable doubt. Because that's what we had after we watched that case. Several of us watching the Brian Andrews case, Sherry Peterson, Becky Johnson, and I. In any case, you'll be hearing a little bit of that. You're going to be hearing lots of interviews on the street tonight, some music. And remember, this is recorded. You're listening to 96.3 FM, Bathurst Spears Broadside. So stay with us. And better still, get down to the Civic Auditorium, which right now you can get hot tamales and rice and beans from one of the most excellent chefs in the city, India Joe Schultz, sponsored by himself and not by India Joe's, to stop the Beach Boardwalk boondoggle, the Seaside Company sellout, and talk back to the Canfield City Council, the actual residents of the beach flats that are down there right now.
Through the sun and walk through the rain. Here is the land full of time. Texas and Ohio and the California shore. Tell me who could ask for more, for here is a land of power and glory. Give me that word that I recall. Her power shall rest on the strength of the creek, and her glory shall rest on the floor. Yet she's only as rich as the poorest of the poor, only as free as a padlocked prison door, only as strong as our love for this land, only as tall as we stand. For here is a land of power and glory, give me that word that I recall. Oh, her power shall rest on the strength of the freedom, her glory shall rest on the floor.
And they're running it. They're running the whole damn show. And, oh, well, we wanted to name the Froggy Time Master. The rest of the people are working everybody around here in time and space. You know, wake up from the dream. You ain't going anywhere, and you ain't been anywhere. You're here and clear.
You heard it first on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
You got that right.
Thank you.
Closing phases of the Brian Andrews trial. It's Monday, September 28th. And joining us is attorney Hugh Wells. Actually, it's about an hour and a half ago when the afternoon session began. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
And Kate, you haven't been here for most of the trial, but this is the first time you've showed up. But you have an interest in this case. And you were observing, I guess, the dialogue between Judge Attic and the two attorneys, defense and prosecution, around the jury instructions. Can you give us an idea of what are jury instructions and what the significance was of what goes in and doesn't go in?
It would be that if they give a jury instruction on a particular topic, then it will lead the jury to believe that that topic is relevant. So the court has to be careful in not giving jury instructions that would lead the jurors to believe that a situation was true that there was no evidence about.
Now, what exactly is a jury instruction?
Jury instruction is how the court instructs jury as to the law. And
an example of a jury instruction.
An example of a jury instruction would be that you are to ignore the order in which I read the jury instructions because there is no particular no significance.
That's the most important first or something like that.
Correct. That would be an example of a standing jury instruction that's given in every trial.
Now, you heard Judge Attic deny a number of defense jury instructions, seemingly more than the prosecution. He seemed to deny most of the defense instructions, at least that I heard, and only maybe one of the prosecution instructions. Any comment on the particulars of that, or perhaps the general impact of that?
Well, as I see it, what the reason that there have been several turned down on the part of the defense is that the judge has made the determination that there has been no evidence presented.
No substantial evidence.
Well, yeah, but I'm not even sure that any evidence has been presented that this was self-defense. And evidently, the defense attorney has several instructions that would deal with the defense of self-defense. So that would explain how so many of the defense proposed instructions were denied.
Any comments about the way it's looking to you in terms of what you're, is the jury going to be, how is the jury's ability to deliberate going to be impacted by the judge's rulings on jury instructions?
Well, I think that, obviously, the prosecution argued that even, this isn't true, that even the, they shouldn't even give a defense of others instruction. And not having been here to see what the evidence is, it's a hard one to say. It does appear that there's mostly circumstantial evidence that it was in the defense of his wife. So I would say that that's a coup for the defense that they were able to get the instructions in, because at that point now it gives credibility to that defense. Just the mere fact that the judge is reading an instruction about it gives credibility and strength to that argument.
Any other comments on the specific jury instructions that might, I think, give us some clue as to what the jury is going to have to go through here? What does it lead them in any direction?
Well, it's clear that whether or not this was a lawful entry is going to play a huge role in terms of the decision of the jury. And not having, again, been here to see the previous testimony, it's hard for me to say whether or not that's going to be a defense or a prosecution victory.
I would have thought that the defense would have brought a lot of experts around about lawful entry and unlawful entry, put into the record defense protocols and discuss past instances when domestic violence is considered the appropriate justification for breaking into a house where the lesser means of force can be used. Unfortunately, these things were only briefly referred to by John Burton, the defense attorney.
Well, again, I haven't done any specific research in this area, so it could be that he did a lot of research and done it, but they did have a problem. In which case, then talk about it a little bit.
Well, that actually makes me wonder why I just wasn't calling him glass. It's just kind of like his vision was specifically referred to. It's just talking about glass.
Again, my guess would be that the result wouldn't be that great. But he's doing a very good job of circumstantial evidence.
Oh dear, well.
He has them for reading.
Thank you very much.
Formerly the Garden Mall, now the sterile concrete mall.
The pathetic Garden Mall.
The pathetic Garden Mall, yeah. And it's Monday evening. We're near the coffee roasting company. Actually, we're in front of Bunny's Shoes. Talking to
Damon.
Damon. And Damon, you've got a very interesting bike here. It's a bike, and then attached to it is a sort of a, looks like a forbidden milk crate, and then a kind of a platform on wheels with a trunk on it. I guess you got some street spirits and other papers in there. How long have you been in town?
On and off about a year.
And you say that now the police are starting to leave you alone for selling street spirit. You've been selling it for a while?
About a week.
And you've been pretty good business, or how's that going?
It's good on the weekends, kind of crappy during the weekdays.
But you say now they're telling you that your bike is too long, or your, what do you call this thing? It almost looks like a travois, like a, you know, sort of a bike trailer.
Yeah,
it's
too long.
Yeah. So what are they saying about that?
They've been hollering at me for not parking in the bike rack.
How could you park it in the bike rack? It would block the entire sidewalk.
Kind of. It's 12 feet long, but he's back.
So, how many times a day have the police commented about this? Or has it been the police that have been concerned with this?
The cops talked to me with a bike once, and once they hollered at me, and you can't be begging here. I wasn't begging, I saw in the newspaper on the sidewalk. It was about an hour before the sunset.
How long ago was this?
About 3 days.
So 3 days ago, you remember the name of the police officer who shouted, you can't be begging here, when you were selling the paper?
Something like that. Hollered from across the street.
It was?
I think it was Officer Overkill.
Yes, Martin Overweight. I mean, Overkill. Which I shouldn't be talking about that paunchy guy that I am.
We're pretty much out of the current one, so we're going to back issue.
We're speaking to Billy Godwin. Berkeley?
Billy
Godwin?
Billy Godwin. And Billy, what's the story?
Berkeley, what's happening is the house is what was it, a denigrated term? I can't use that anymore. God gives us a home. We have a home, but we have no house. He doesn't give us a house. Up in Berkeley, they're doing something about this. What they're doing is camping out at the post office. And, you know, that old saying, don't make a federal case out of it. Well, that's exactly what they're doing up there. They're going to make a federal issue out of this, take the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. We've already paid for the federal buildings. Why can't we sleep in? Buy a postage stamp, spend the night.
Put it on your forehead. I heard from activist John Vance in Berkeley that on Monday you guys had a sleepout up there a week ago. What's been happening since?
Well, I've been gone for about 3 or 4 days, but it's been on all the local news programs on television. It's really getting to where it's making a big splash. And I believe that this is something that they could use as a coast-to-coast movement, because it's a federal, so that, say, a local ordinance bans you from camping within city limits, like, say, Santa Cruz. Well, you can violate that by going and camping at the post office, because it's federal land. They have no jurisdiction. So
that issue was raised, actually, 8 years ago, and we had an 8.5-month vigil near the post office, main post office here in Santa Cruz, called the Homeless Table, running from November 1989 to July 1990. And several times, many people slept under the eaves of the post office. There were tickets given, and I'm not quite sure whether they were successfully defended by claiming the jurisdiction was inadequate. Although, you know, that would seem to be an argument, although, of course, on state property, that's a good question. I'm not sure what's going on.
It's federal property. So you have to bring in someone federal, like FBI.
U.S. Marshal.
U.S. Marshal. And so it's one way around these little local bands that they put in, you know, whoever decides.
If I could deputize you to ticket office.
Yes. Yes. I have a star.
You already got your star, you got your hat, and you got your chocolate vanilla.
Who's better?
Best in town.
We're into justice. Law does not equal justice, no peace. So let's focus on justice instead of the laws that this people institute.
Thank you, Billy.
Well, thank you, sir.
Let's imagine you're in a house this afternoon. What happened? You were sleeping?
Sleeping under a redwood tree next to the highway. Cops pulled over somebody for drunk driving next to it. Basically, with all the action going on around, I was afraid of a stray flashlight being finding me and me getting busted for sleeping.
Now, is this inside or outside city limits?
Inside.
Where the infamous sleeping ban or the sleeping provisions of the camping ban apply?
Yeah.
Well, it certainly keeps you on your toes, that sleeping ban, doesn't it?
I just hurried up and packed some shit. The second the cops are gone, I was too. Just in case they come back. Because they turned around and nailed somebody about a couple hundred yards down the road.
Or?
Don't know. I left.
Thank you.
And these were interviews earlier this week on the Pacific Garden Mall. Garden is used historically rather than descriptively. There are a couple of comments I want to make about these interviews. Street Spirit and Street Shit Chief, two homeless papers, are now being sold downtown. Street Spirit is out of San Francisco. It's a much more colorful, upscale production than Street Shit Sheet. And you can pick up these papers near the Cinema 9, in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz, in different places along the Pacific Garden Mall. And if you buy them, they're $1, I think, for the Street Spirit and 50 cents for the Street Shit Sheet, which is the homeless newsletter that I put out, most of it written by me. I'm your host, Robert Norris, here, and in case you've forgotten, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3. This is a recorded edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. I'm down at the City Council at Civic Auditorium. I encourage you to come on down and tell the City Council to let Latino people from the Beach Flats speak, to delay their decision about the Beach Flats plan until after the election, or certainly until the October 20th date, when they said they were going to do it. Instead, they're planning to do it on the 6th. And anyway, tell them to hold off till we actually have a people's vote on the question of who's going to be really considering this. Do we want the fate of the city in the hands of Michael Hernandez, Cynthia Matthews, and Michael Rotkin? These are the questions. And at the moment, even among their own constituents, the answer, except for the Sentinel and Charlie Canfield and the Downtown Business Association, seems to be no, no thanks. So come on down to the Civic Auditorium if you're listening to this. It's a feast down there, a fiesta. You can pick up some tamales free. It's all going in honor of the beach area residents who haven't been really allowed to speak in terms of the outreach, the no outreach significantly in Spanish. The plan itself didn't make Spanish translation until early August, when it was quickly rubber stamped by the Planning Commission. And so it's quite a situation. People are trying to mobilize to fight this giveaway of valuable beach boardwalk property, destruction of housing, of low-income housing down there for the beach flats. And we're giving you an alternative for those of you who have to stay at home, or perhaps those of you who are listening to this show being rebroadcast later on the internet. We're trying to set up an internet link, thanks to one of our fine technicians who's trying to put the tapes up on the internet, where unfortunately Free Radio Berkeley continues to be. We are, of course, still at large, still at liberty, still broadcasting 24 hours a day on 96.3 here. And if you've got any comments or questions about my show, give a call to 423-HOP, 423-4833. If you want to contact Free Radio Santa Cruz, give a call to 427-4523. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And before our musical interlude, I want to note that Street Spirit vendor Anthony was literally arrested by Officer Eveleth about a week ago. His Street Spirits confiscated, given a ticket for vending merchandise. But when we took this issue directly to Chief Belcher and Mayor Sylvia Scott, we received a reply from Chief Belcher apologizing for this behavior. I think we read this apology last show, and essentially asserting that Well, he didn't go so far as to assert that people have the right to vend papers, but he did say there was an exception under the merchandise prohibition for newspapers in the city's municipal code. So that has actually increased the interest in vending papers considerably. They're going like hotcakes, where we can't get enough of them to pass on to vendors here. And I encourage you to go check out Street Spirit, Street Shit Sheet. Anthony again was accosted by the tall, steely Officer Eveleth, who I call Officer Everworse. Eveleth stopped our man in front of the Cinema 9 again because he had a paper leaning on his backpack, claimed he did not have personal possession of it, at which point Anthony pulled out the letter from Chief Belcher and Eveleth stalked away. So far it's Anthony 2, Eveleth 0, although apparently Anthony's papers have not yet been returned by the good officer. We'll see if he's bootlegging them in some other city. Probably not. Also should be noted for the folks who were told, as you may know, by our Berkeley visitor, who was talking about the Berkeley protest on the steps of the post office up in Berkeley, it's okay to go sleep on the steps of the post office here in Santa Cruz because it's federal property. While it is federal property, they can give permission to local and state authorities to intervene, so that is something to consider. I think that's what we found back in 1990. That didn't stop us then, and it shouldn't stop us now. People want to sleep there, particularly as the weather turns colder, and the sleeping ban continues to be the law of the land here. But they should know what they're getting into. Also, regarding the Brian Andrus case, it's interesting that the self-defense that Brian Andrus wanted to use was denied by the court, claimed there was not substantial evidence, though he would allow evidence about the defense of others that Brian Andrus may have been justified in using possibly lethal force with a baseball bat against the officers, though the officers were not seriously injured at all. They shortly thereafter issued a Code 4, which means officers unharmed, because of the threat to his perception that they were being threatened by unknown people invading his house and grabbing his wife. Apparently, although again it's hard to tell what was in the minds of the two jurors who said not guilty to this, that may have been one of the considerations that led to that not guilty verdict.
Crumble in a web of loneliness.
escaping souls are drifting by. Dull the pain of living as they slowly die. Smiles change into a sneer washed away by whiskey tears in the quicksand of their mind. They disappear. Still nobody buying flowers from the flower lane. Evil aged people almost to their knees. Complain about the present, raising memories. Never find their pot of gold.
Yeah, I could pick them out. I'll never forget their faces. have a people's lineup later on. In any case, they told you that they wanted to look at your proof of insurance and your registration. You were standing outside your vehicle when you had this conversation?
Yeah, I was standing outside the vehicle, and the dark-haired police officer told me that if I tried anything while I was going in to get my registration and proof of insurance, he would shoot me.
Now, he said this in what context? Did he say it? You were telling me he said this in the context of, wouldn't it be better to let him go into your vehicle and search for it? Wasn't that the inference?
The inference being, if I allow them permission to go in to the glove box, it would be a lot safer for me because they might have to shoot me if I went in.
I see. So in other words, even though they didn't have probable cause for a search, in fact, they may not even have had reasonable suspicion to believe that a crime was being committed. In fact, no basis for talking to you whatsoever, but I assume you were continuing to talk to them, which may have been an error. He was just an officer, leave me alone, I'm trying to rest here before I go on. They then were telling you that they wanted you to abandon the sanctity of your vehicle on threat of being shot if you yourself went in to get the driver's license, or actually, the registration, or the insurance, or at least making some kind of comment that put you in some apprehension.
Yeah, it was an attempt to create a situation in which they could search my van, give them the opportunity to search my van. In this case, there was no probable cause. They had no right to ask. But
in fact, they did search it, shine the searchlight in, and saw a kind of a plastic baggie of what they assumed was marijuana. And what happened then?
They found the plastic bag in my van, which contained basil, the herb basil, and I had to inform them that it was, in fact, basil and not marijuana.
They then confirmed this by sniffing it?
Yes, they did.
They didn't get too high, probably. They could do any cooking at that point?
No, but I mentioned that I did use it for camping, and that was the gist of the evening with the Santa Cruz police.
Well said. Well, so in other words, all you shoppers out, all you sleepers out there, all you people who are in your vans at 3:30 at night resting, to rest, remember, in Santa Cruz is not illegal. It's only to sleep in a van or to cover up with blankets outside of a van that's illegal. You do not have to allow police to search your vehicle, and you then successfully resisted the search, correct?
To the best of my ability, I almost gave them permission to search my glove box. I mean, once given the permission to search the glove box, he could have lied about not searching the rest of the van at that point. He had the authority to search the rest of the van, and I would have been out of luck if there were
any contraband
of any kind in the van.
Or you might have felt your privacy violated even if there weren't any contraband in your van.
Well, certainly, I don't like having people go through my personal belongings. I sleep in my van. I have all my personal belongings in there, and I don't like other people going through them. I think that's just basic to personal privacy.
The rights that Americans should have, or anybody living in the United States should have, vis-a-vis the police department and vis-a-vis other citizens. You know, it's interesting. A request to search your van can be turned down, as you did turn it down. But I imagine it took you some courage to do that. I guess at some point, were you a bit apprehensive that the police might use some force?
Well, the comment made about the shooting was, I felt as though that was a bit extreme given the circumstances. At that point in time, I mentioned that they were the ones with the guns, not me, and they'd be the ones